What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off. Philippe Bacazzi is the CEO of XBTO Group. In this conversation, we discuss the Yellow Vest protests in Paris, his days working at SAC Capital, how the global financial crisis impacted many people in crypto today, why the interest in crypto is like a wave, and the importance of Tether, stablecoins, and derivatives in cryptocurrency. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do as well. As many of you know, crypto investors store their digital assets on exchanges or in cold storage for long-term safekeeping. However, this strategy doesn't help them grow their investment holdings or build overall wealth. With the new BlockFi interest account, users can now securely store their Bitcoin or Ether at BlockFi and receive 6% annual interest paid monthly in cryptocurrency. 6% is an absurdly high rate. It's the best rate in the industry. I highly suggest you go check out BlockFi.com/pomp. Again, that's BlockFi.com/pomp to sign up and start earning crypto today.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I'm here with Philippe. You got an awesome background, lots to talk about. You're born in Paris, right? Or lived in Paris?
Lived in Paris. I was born in New York. Okay. I lived a couple of years in New York. Spent most of my childhood in Paris. Came back to the U.S. was about 19.
Okay. Yeah. What remember anything that was kind of a big clash of cultures living
Huge.
In and growing up in Paris?
Absolutely. You know, you grow up in Paris and there's less this attraction to money over there. It's really, growing up, I was more about, I would say I was more of an intellectual. Mm-hmm. You can't really say that when you're a teen, but effectively I was really interested in anything that had nothing to do with finance. I was good in math, I was good in things like that, but nothing that really got me interested in derivatives or things like that, where I am currently very much involved in. I was more interested in film and doing artsy things and skating and
absolutely. And then what's going on with the protest, the yellow vest stuff, right? Because that's all happening in Paris. I think it's like every Saturday or Sunday they just go out one day a week and protest.
Yeah, this has been going on for a while, a lot longer than I thought it would. I thought it would die down, fairly quickly. It seems like there is this underlying malaise that keeps coming back. And, France has got this sort of culture of rebellion, revolution. And I think people express their anger. They come, they don't mind going into the streets and talking to the government in that way, And in a way, it's very, from a marketing standpoint, this whole yellow vest thing is very, very, very smart. And they managed to utilize social networks very well. The momentum that it takes to get to that level is amazing. It started with one person.
My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that everyone in maybe France, but Paris is required to keep one of these yellow vests in their car.
Correct.
And for, they break down or whatever for safety reasons. And the initial yellow vest protest was over some gas pricing.
Correct.
Right? The taxes around gas really drove the prices up. Everyone freaks out.
Yep.
And as a way to show they are pissed off about that specifically, they all grab the yellow vest from their cars, put them on, went into the streets and, kind of mayhem ensued. One, the yellow vests are obviously very noticeable.
Sure.
Two, the protest, I think, now around the world is being known as the yellow vest protest, right? It is the way people talk about it. But it also has this significance of it's what's in the car, right? And the gas and all that, which is pretty cool. Is that generally right?
That's generally right. I think, it started out because there was an increase in taxes. Supposedly, it was supposed to be a green tax because we had to be green, right? But this tax really didn't hurt anyone that had money. It really hurt people that didn't have money and were struggling and that used a lot of their, taxis and things like that.
people like that. And so it was kind of ill-guided and ill-presented, and it just blew up. And it takes less to start a revolution. You know, these are, you know, these things kind of get out of control. So, and I think it took them too long to realize that they were on the path, on the wrong path from a government standpoint in terms of managing this crisis. And so we'll see, we'll have to see where this goes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Certainly interesting.
I mean, look, the famous photo now of the guy standing in the yellow vest with the buy Bitcoin written on the back is, I think, one that will stick around for a long time and probably become more important over time. This is pretty cool. But all right, so you come back to the US and you end up at SAC. At some point. Tell everyone what SAC was, and then we can get into kind of, I'm sure, crazy stories or a time there.
Sure. Well, to get to SAC, basically, when I got to the US, I went to college, and in college it was about 1998, 1999, and the market was, you know, still hot. Right. And in my dorm room, effectively everybody was day trading. Everybody was like crazy about, like, you know, trading stocks and making money. And I was like, what is going on here? And I got curious. I got very curious. And I have this obsession about things. So when I get curious, I spend a lot of time studying on things. And I started thinking about, you know, how I could, you know, use some of my skills to make money in the market. And I was early on, I started developing bots, even neural net bots that actually didn't do anything at the time. It was really like more of a trying to sort of figure things out. But it was the early days of what would become, you know, XBTO and just generally algorithmic trading. So for 4 years, I studied communications, film, radio, TV, and also studied finance and derivatives. And at the end of my four-year, you know, college time, I had to pay, you know, the hard reality of having to pay your bills came, and you're like, okay, yeah, I really have to get a real job here. So where can I, you know, where can I work, where I'm going to be? Where I can be good and make money, you know, and not get bored. And I had read about, you know, the market wizards and, you know, and I thought, you know, it'd be interesting to go and work for one of these, you know, big hedge funds. And certainly got lucky there. Managed to get through, I think, four rounds of interviews. Wow. I was straight out of college and ended up on the global macro desk. That was just starting out, and they need a bit of a junior guy to do a little bit of everything. To be honest, there's no risk system. There was nothing, and at the time, it was just building the desk. It was very, very interesting, very formative years. 4 years of it's amazing. The caliber of people there, the amount of sheer money that was just moving. You know, when you're just out of college, it's mind blowing, and you're sort of in a constant, you're almost constantly paralyzed by what's going on. Every time the market moved a little bit more of a few standard deviations, you're like, wow, this is insane.
Absolutely. Well, any Steve Cohen stories?
There are plenty, but I'd prefer not to discuss any of them.
That's fine.
The times where, I think I look back and it was just crazy. There are, plenty of times where I thought, you know, these were just bigger than life, sort of reality stranger than fiction. And when you look at billions, you can kind of sort of imagine some of these stories. I mean, too, of course, they're very dramatized. But he's an amazing, you know, amazing trader. Great eye on the market. And
I mean, everything I've heard, right, is the guy can sit down in front of a screen, doesn't even really need to know what the asset is, and just from a technical standpoint, can start trading and turn a profit, which is a pretty incredible skill set if that's true.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. All right. So after SAC, then we get, this is all kind of pre-global financial crisis, right, if I understand correctly, and then we go through the global financial crisis.
Right.
Talk to me about kind of
coming from the traditional financial system, coming from literally working, you know, hedge fund, Wall Street, all this stuff, and the global financial crisis happens, what are like you and your friends thinking about, talking about, experiencing as all of this is going on? Is it kind of surreal? Is it like, holy shit, our hairs are on fire, you know, and the whole thing's burning? What was kind of the general sense among that community at that point?
Well, it was a crazy time. I mean, I left SSC in, I think, in May of 07 before the first tremors mm-hmm. hit. And I think that the first tremors were basically in the summer of 07. And it didn't really hit until, you know, like then there's fall, Lehman yeah. and all that. But it was a gradual fall, and you could tell something, mm-hmm. you know, is just, you know, it's just falling apart.
Yeah, kind of a snowball rolling.
It was a snowball, absolutely. And so, you know, I had a lot of friends who were still on trading desk at that time. I'd gone to New Zealand and just traveling the world, and I was just a bit disconnected, which was actually a great time to be disconnected because, you know, a lot of my friends got a lot of their lines pulled, right? Mm-hmm. Guys at Lehman, sales guys, you know, they just kind of overnight, you know, a lot of hedge funds just said, we've got to pull the Lehman lines. You know, yep. we just can't talk to them anymore. You know, this is really, really brutal, right? And yeah, I had a lot of friends who were still on a trading desk, and their days were absolutely horrendous. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of guys made a lot of money, but a lot of guys who had, you know, basically had made money 20 years straight with a mm-hmm. certain strategy that, of course, had certain volatility mm-hmm. biases, you know, mostly short vol strats. You just got blown out of water. I mm-hmm. mean, their VARs just went through the roof.
Well, it's a trade, yeah. right? So when the market goes up, people are making money, yeah. some people are yeah. losing. And when the market goes yeah. down, some people are making it, some are losing,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
People always forget that, yes, the global financial crisis was incredibly bad in terms of if you're an everyday citizen. But there's a lot of people on Wall Street who actually made money during that time too.
Absolutely. There's a lot of money that got made, and we don't need to mention who made the they are quite you know, they're celebrities.
They're well known. Absolutely. Yep. Well, and you know, one of my theories with crypto is people kind of, I don't know, let's call it 25 to 35, right? In that general
yes.
Time frame, were old enough during the global financial crisis to see it, to experience it, but didn't have enough personal wealth to really get crushed by it.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
And so they got just enough of a taste. They were just cognizant enough to see, you know, what were these huge institutions that no one ever could have thought, you know, could become insolvent, actually fall, or, you know, be on their knees and the government have to come in and bail them out. Mm-hmm. And I think that what you see now in crypto is a lot of those same types of people, right? They fit that demographic. They were kind of paying attention, but not really hurt themselves. They're super excited about crypto, right? And I think that has a lot to do with it, that the psychologically they were kind of exposed to the global financial crisis, yet didn't actually get hurt.
Right. Yeah, you know, it's this white paper. I'm not sure if this white paper had come out in the middle of the 90s, if it had the same impact as just, you know, in December of 2008, I think, mm-hmm. it probably took a really important stage. You know, it was perfect timing. Mm-hmm. You know, Hashcash, which came out much earlier, didn't really get the same kind of attention. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're right. The age demographic is important in Bitcoin and in crypto. And that's why I think that time is crypto's friend, because as time goes on, right, you've got more people, you know, they get a little bit older, and mm-hmm. You know, but you basically have the non-believers that just kind of don't matter anymore, and they just kind of fall off the map, and you've got more. So I think over time, you're going to have more believers mm-hmm. and more holders, and so that's going to be a good thing. I'm not saying every crypto is good, but mm-hmm. Certainly.
Well, look, and the part for me that is so interesting is that as people get older, they will get access to more assets. And then every person who's now coming into the system, if you will, right? So kind of coming out of college or coming out of high school and hitting a certain age, now they're actually presented with legacy finance or crypto, if that's what they're interested in. And so the people who were kind of already exposed, right, to, you know, the virus, they're infected. Like as they grow older, that's not going anywhere.
Yep.
And they're actually likely to pull in or infect those younger people as they come in. And so you get kind of this net gain in the number of people who are interested in crypto and decentralized finance, et cetera. And that number is going to get really big, really fast, just given kind of the trends that we're seeing already.
Yeah, the network effect is starting to take a hold, and it's amazing to see. What's amazing to me, being in, you know, XBTO, we get people right out of school. They want to work in blockchain. They want to work in crypto, and they're brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, wow, he's really taking a risk here. Mm-hmm. But it's, he doesn't even, these people, these prospects, they're not even thinking in terms of risk reward. They know. Almost. They know what they want. And it's amazing to see them say, basically, I could go work for pretty much anyone on the street, but I'm choosing this. XBTO is 4 years old, you know, for example. So it's not, it doesn't have the cachet of a Goldman or a Merrill or, and, you know, and it's in the new generation wants to do things that really matter to them in their heart. They have a different approach. They're maybe a little less pragmatic about life. You know, you have to make money. You have to do your career the way it was set out by your parents. No, it's very different, and it's great. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. It's interesting because as we've gone in 2017 and we saw, you know, you're talking about kind of late 90s was trading in the dorm rooms of stocks.
Yep.
Well, guess what was happening in dorm rooms in 2017? People were trading crypto.
Exactly. And mining.
Right there. Mining and trading. And so it's, you know, human nature doesn't change. But then early 2000s, bam, all these people go through this deep bear market, right? And this kind of bubble pops. 2017 actually was much smaller, right? 17 and 18 in terms of the bull market and then the bear market. But if those people were young during the bull market and now have persisted through what looks to be like it's an ending crypto winter, I think that now as they're coming out of school, like, I want to go work on it. You know, it's kind of like this feeling of that's the worst that could happen was what we just experienced. It drew down 85%, and I'm more excited today than I was when it was at, you know, Bitcoin's price was 20,000. That's pretty compelling, I think, for a lot of these kids that, you know, are just excited about the technology and the impact it can have.
Yeah. You know, I like to look at the market as more as in waves rather than bubbles, because bubbles, they pop and then what happens?
Yep.
You know, goes away. But this does not go away. So you have huge waves that come in and then they come out, and then the next wave is even bigger, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, these people that got, they get washed away, you know, at the top, they buy 19,000 and then they're like, oh, I can't take this anymore. They sell at 14,000. But when the market comes back, now they're the guys who said, oh, I've been there before, I've learned, and they're back and they get back in. Mm-hmm. And you may not have, maybe not 100% do come back and they say, I'm burnt, that's it for life. But most of them are going to be like, well, this thing didn't go away. Mm-hmm. And now I've learned, you know, a few lessons, and I'm going to come back and be smarter about how I'm going to get involved in crypto. And so every time the wave comes in, the wave is bigger. There's more people. And that's why this thing is not, I don't think it's going to go away. In 10 years, it'll be massive.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you know, what's the chart where you basically look at the annual low, right? Mm-hmm. Every year over year,
it's, you have a higher, you
know,
low.
Almost every single year, there's a higher low.
Yep.
And that, you know, to your point, kind of as the wave draws back, it's in a better place than it was the year before. So yeah. I think that's probably backed up by data as well. All right. So you're building a bunch of stuff,
yes,
involved in a whole bunch of different things. Give us kind of an overview of your world and kind of where you guys are spending time building versus spending time allocating capital.
That's a good question. We started in basically in 2014. We wanted to provide better liquidity to the market. That was essentially how we got involved in crypto on a business, from a business standpoint. I had invested a little bit in crypto and mined a little bit. trying to understand where blockchain was, what it meant to the world. And in 2014, I approached one of the exchanges here in New York and I said, listen, we can work together. I'll start thinking about how I could provide good liquidity to your market. Everybody wins, your customer wins, the exchange wins, we win. And maybe there's a way to expand outside of this exchange. Of course, this was just sort of a proof of concept. And yeah, it really worked out well, and we grew to many more exchanges. I think globally we're on more than 35 exchanges and in different currencies. And so we are a systematic algorithmic shop. 99% of the trades we do are just done by the computer. Mm-hmm. So we spend a lot of time building. Actually don't spend a whole lot of time looking at the markets, because there's not really not anything I can do. I just cut my risk here and there once in a while when it makes sense, but I'm not on the computer clicking away and saying, oh, you know, there's a descending triangle here, or doing like technical analysis, because most of it is just done by the computers. And we have hundreds of algos running concurrently.
And what are those algorithms doing? Are they doing more like exchange arbitrage? Are they looking at things like volume, price movements, trends? Just kind of give people an understanding of the different variables that an algorithm can look at to do algorithmic trading.
Yeah, these algorithms over the years have gotten very complex. They look at mostly technical stuff in the sense that you've got your price, you got your volumes, you've got your volatility, and those are kind of like the trinity in trying to figure out how to make money. There's liquidity, of course, which goes with volume. And I can't get into the actual details of the algos, of course, but
they are
statistically led, algos based on expected value over many occurrences. Mm-hmm. And we do cross, of course, there's a lot of cross-border ARB, cross-exchange ARB, correlation ARBs. Mm-hmm. Anything that you would find in your traditional hedge fund, quant hedge fund, you'll probably find at XBTL. Yeah.
Got it. All right. So you've got the quant hedge fund side. Then you guys are also working on Stablehouse.
Yes.
Right. And so tell us a little bit about what that is and kind of why you guys think that's important.
Yeah. So we're not a hedge fund. We're a proprietary trading company. I just want to say that so that it's quite clear. We do have an index fund with a little bit of a beta overlay, a smart beta overlay, can we call it that way. And we have the VC fund that is also investing with us in companies that we like.
So the quant fund, VC fund, index fund are three main buckets of work.
Correct. And the mining. We do some mining also. Yeah. Actually, for your question.
And Stablehouse fits
right.
Where?
So Stablehouse is the next generation of exchange. In our mind, it's kind of a clearinghouse. Mm-hmm. It started under the sort of assumption that, well, there's going to be a lot of stable coins. They're basically going to do the same thing for the most part. They might be based on different blockchains. Mm-hmm. Some may be slower, some may be quicker, some may be audited, some may not be audited. Some may have a better bank than others, but effectively, for the most part, they're sort of, pegged on the same underlying risk asset or currency in this case. The dollar to start with, because that's where there's the most, there's the more stable coins, right? So you have, you've got Tether, which was the first amazing trailblazing idea. I mean, it was really revolutionary when you think about it, but it took time, for the market to really realize how important Tether was in its, in the concept of it. During the bear cycle, Tether became very important. People fled to Tether for safety. Mm-hmm. And so Tether was ruling stablecoins for a long time. And then there was, over the last maybe 6 to 9 months, an explosion in stablecoins. There were a few others before, but for the most part, all the Paxos, the Geminis, the Circle coins, the Stables, the whatever, they're all came to be in the last, you know, 9 months to a year. And these all basically have the same function. It's mm-hmm. all dollars in a bank account that is tokenized and sitting on a blockchain, you know. So it's not anything new. It's just a kind of a bare dollar that sits on a public blockchain that can be moved around and faster or slower at more or less expensive rates. Mm-hmm. And what we've decided to do as a clearinghouse is say, well, we're going to focus on these stable coins because these stable coins, most people don't want the market risk. Mm-hmm. They may say crypto, you know, they liken crypto to all this volatility, you know, Bitcoin, Ethereum, it goes up 100%, goes down 200%. Mm-hmm. You know, it's people are just focused on this risk of crypto. And I think stable coins fill in this gap of saying, well, you're in some kind of crypto because a stable coin is backed by cryptography at the end of the day. It's mm-hmm. still, you know, secured on a blockchain. Mm-hmm. That is Ethereum for the most part, is backed by cryptography, right? So you can't double spend, you can't do a lot of things that what the blockchain actually provides in terms of security and accountability. And we believe that basically through a clearinghouse like Stablehouse, you're going to be able to do remittances, payments, mm-hmm. cross-border, you know, transfers on things that basically are like a SWIFT, mm-hmm. a better SWIFT.
Mm-hmm. And so by going after the kind of clearinghouse model, let's just call it that just for yeah. ease of terminology, is the thought process that you start out with more of kind of a centralized clearinghouse model and then over time you can decentralize it? Is there a belief that like you need the more centralized to make it more efficient and lower cost? Just walk me through kind of the different lenses of like you can make it fully centralized, you would get fully decentralized. Kind of where did you guys end up and why?
So we believe that you will always have to trust someone at some point in blockchain.
Okay.
You just have to figure out where it makes the most sense to trust someone. People like to talk to people, right? They like to have interaction. They don't like to talk to a robot, you know, for the most part. You press zero when you call a call center, always, you know, don't care about the message. You want to chat with someone. And I don't think that's going to go away. I think people, they will want to trust someone with their needs. And everybody isn't, you know, a geek or a nerd mm-hmm. Someone that's very well knowledgeable in computers, or especially, I mean, in crypto, you're managing money, and this money that you're trying to secure yourself, it's kind of dangerous. So you're still going to be a vast majority of people who are going to be trusting money on exchanges. Mm-hmm. When the minute you trust money on an exchange, that means you have a counterparty, you're trusting someone, right? I don't know that there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be like, I'm going to, you know, take my private keys with me and store them and figure out the whole governance. If I go under a bus, this is what happens to my ledger or my treasure.
Yep.
No, you know, I don't think so. So at Stablehouse, we decided that there's going to be it's not atomic swaps on blockchain. It is a bunch of market makers that come together that provide liquidity in all the stable coins that they have, that they want to inventory. And they basically swap between each other, mm-hmm. these stable coins. And it's you basically taking very little counterparty risk in the sense that what we're envisioning is what we call a swap on Stablehouse is basically you're trading a Paxos for a Gemini dollar, and you're sending the Paxos to Stablehouse, and Stablehouse will tell you before you send it if there's enough liquidity to turn it into a Gemini dollar at par. Mm-hmm. It's always par because mm-hmm. it's the same underlying risk, and there's a little bit of a fee, but there's not this concept of a order book where you're going to have huge amounts of slippage, and you have this, oh, you got to deposit the coin, wait for the deposit, you're going to go trade. It's very inefficient. This will basically allow you to say, I don't have any Gemini. This guy guy wants or wants Gemini. I only have Paxos. I can send it to Stablehouse in one fell swoop, and you're taking risk to Stablehouse for basically the time the blockchain takes to secure that transaction, which can be two or three depending on the blockchain, right? Most of the times on Bitcoin's 2 to 3 transactions. I think Omni is about the same. You know, Ethereum's a little different. So this is, and we said, you know, that's okay. That's a risk. That's okay. You know, you're really, it's 5 minutes counterparty risk. We're totally okay with it because the value is so much bigger. Now you're providing, you can provide real liquidity that way. You wouldn't be able to do that with being completely decentralized.
And so that makes sense. And then let's talk about Deribit.
Yes.
Right? So Deribit is a company that you guys invested in, or?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Got it. And explain a little bit of what they're doing around derivatives and all that.
So we like to invest in companies that are very different, that offer something different. And it could be different regional market or a very different product. In this case, Deribit were the first ones to start with options on Bitcoin. And it took a long time for them to develop that market, create the momentum and network effects. And we thought this is going to be important if in 10 years Bitcoin's still around. You betcha that derivatives on Bitcoin is going to be a big thing. So we're always early movers, and we feel like because we're a bit of a strategic player and that we know derivatives well, we thought we could provide a lot of value to a company like Deribit. And, you know, over the years, it blew my mind how actually it grew so fast. And now it's like a top, you know, depending on where you look. It's going to be a top 10 exchange. On certain sites, it'll be top 5 exchange most of the days these days. And that's amazing, you know? And they really have a product that no one else has today. It's very hard to do.
And what is the main differentiation?
The differentiation for Deribit is that they have all these options strips that, and they have also this risk management engine that makes it very easy for a market maker, very capital efficient for a market maker to participate in it. And that's very important. That's one of the things that, that regulation has kind of, it's created some real problems in derivatives is that it's sort of hampered the ability to really provide the product that the market wants. You know, a lot of times regulation will say, for right or wrong, you cannot do this. And that thing is the defining thing that makes that product valuable, right? And so Deribit has been able to provide that service in a way that, and the markets sort of embrace it in recent times enormously. It's been great.
It's awesome. And what you're talking about, right, with the stablecoin clearinghouse, with derivatives, some of these are complex products. Some of them are complex mechanisms, right? And crypto is unique in that this is all happening across multiple jurisdictions and geographies, right? And so regulation becomes this huge complex thing where not only do I have the product that's complex, but I'm also compounding that with I have to be compliant or I have to figure out the rules in what could be, you know, 30, 40, 50 jurisdictions.
Yeah.
How do you guys think about that, right? When you're looking at making investments or participating and building some of this stuff, just how do you handle that?
It's a really good question. So crypto is global. Crypto is cross-border. Crypto does not know any jurisdiction. That's the reality. Now, you can try to put crypto in a box and say, this crypto is going to be governed by XYZ jurisdiction. But the problem is, when you do that, is that you open yourself to regulatory arbitrage. A lot of companies, very successful companies, we won't even name them, but we know them. That's what they do, you know. How do you stop it? If you get regulated in Singapore, you close up shop, you show up in Jersey. Here you're on BVI. How do you stop it from happening is very, very complex. Now, there are natural barriers like banks. The banking system is a barrier. Because effectively most banks around the world operate under the same sets of standards and rules. And mm-hmm. so that provides a layer that basically stops, I think, crypto from really developing itself to its max potential. There's mm-hmm. a huge friction, right? In the US, back even 2-3 years, super difficult to get a bank account open and to keep the bank mm-hmm. account open. You know, even for players that were relatively credible with a decent amount of money. This has slowly changed, but still you have banks that will not touch crypto. And a lot of, you know, there's still the stigma around crypto.
Yeah. Well, and I think from my standpoint, it is certain jurisdictions have reasons to encourage, right? So, you yep. know, in the US, for example, encouraging innovation has been a competitive advantage for a very, very long mm-hmm. time, right? And I think that we understand that. Yep. There are other jurisdictions that now realize that and are trying to catch up by encouraging some of the stuff. But that is in contrast to, in every jurisdiction, those that are in power say, if I cannot control this, if it actually gives power to somebody else, there's fear, right? Or there's the fear of the unknown, at least. And so I think that it really is fascinating to watch jurisdictions that are kind of flip-flopping, right? So like I always go to tell an entrepreneur what the rules are and they'll figure out how to build companies, right? They'll figure out how to build value. Where there is no clarity, that's where the problems are, right? Because they can't build in a very chaotic environment. And so these countries that, you know, today something's approved, tomorrow it's banned. The next day, well, it's kind of approved, but it's looked down upon. Now it's banned again. Okay, now it's approved. And, you know, just how do you build a business in that environment? It's just really, really hard to do.
In crypto in general, because everything is so volatile, whether it's mm-hmm. the regulatory, you know, framework or the asset prices, or, you know, it's just very difficult to run a 100% crypto business. It really mm-hmm. is. And the other issue about having these for a lot of offshore jurisdictions have had a hard time with the crisis. A lot of these jurisdictions have not really rebounded since then, and they're trying to reinvent themselves. Trying to bring in blockchain, trying to bring in fintech and mm-hmm. these crypto, but a lot of them are at the helm of still banks, you know, because the banks at the end of the day, to get involved in crypto, you still need some kind of gateway, payment mm-hmm. gateway. Mm-hmm. And so they can do, and I've seen it a bunch of times because I'm a sort of unofficial advisor to a lot of these countries. You know, the main issue is that they have a hard time bringing in companies because these companies can't even open a bank account because mm-hmm. you've got the stigma of, oh no, you're in crypto. This is, you know, yep. our correspondent bank is going to kill us.
Yep.
You know, and you know, the maybe. Banks have a real meaningful business, a book of business. And, you know, to take a flyer on a company that's unproven, that, you know, maybe it's one of the bigger in the space, but still too little to matter. And so they're, you know, rightfully they're afraid of that. And we'll have to see where this goes. It'll take time. It'll take time for all these jurisdictions to normalize their rules and standards and regulation. And that needs to happen because it's global. And absolutely. Until you have a uniform standard, it's just going to be difficult for everyone.
I completely agree. Before I wrap up, rapid fire questions. Most important company in crypto?
The more I think about crypto and the more I think that I'll say Binance because right now it's the flavor of the day, mm-hmm. but in 6 months, it may be someone else. You know, I'd love to say things change so rapidly, mm-hmm. right, that it's really hard to say anything definitively. So today I'll say Binance because in fact, they are really running very fast. They're it's amazing how they react to new trends. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we all know that crypto moves at 1,000 miles per hour. So they've done a really good job. They've grown the company very fast. It's hard to hire good people, mm-hmm. to trust mm-hmm. good people. Mm-hmm. You know, especially when you have this kind of, you know, this crypto asset is, I don't know how, what their cold wallet is, but it's probably massive.
For sure.
So yeah, I would say that's probably the one that springs to mind right now.
Got it. And I mean, look, at some point, if I'd asked that, you know, 2 years ago, somebody might have said Bitmain. It might not be as important now, right?
Exactly.
So I think that your point about kind of at what point are you asking is important. Regulation, if you could change or improve one, which one would it be?
Well, I've certainly changed the bit license in New York. That's the obvious one because we are we're based here. We're based in Paris also. We have a London presence. We're in Bermuda. But the New York one is the one that everyone sort of looks at.
Yep.
And I think it may need a little bit of, you know, rejiggering and restructuring to be a little bit more friendlier to the space. And maybe we saw what happened to Bittrex recently. It's amazing to me because Bittrex has been in the space for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. They've never had a security issue and they obviously know what they're doing. And to be denied is, they may have had some really good reasons to, but it seems... I don't know.
It's difficult.
It seems difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. What's your most controversial thought? What do you believe that everyone else disagrees with you on?
Well, these days, stablecoins, a lot of people are like, no, stablecoins, what's that? It doesn't make any sense. You buy Bitcoin. and for me, Bitcoin is completely separate from a stablecoin. It's a different use case. They can totally coexist. Yeah, a stable coin is just a representation of a dollar, euro, yen, or whatever asset on a blockchain. That's what it is. It's just digitizing something that exists in the real world. Bitcoin is something completely different. It's a decentralized, immutable ledger. That's money because people believe in it and they have mm-hmm. confidence in it over time. Mm-hmm. And it is completely devoid or void of monetary and fiscal policy, mm-hmm. right? It does its own thing.
Absolutely. Most important book you've ever read?
Wow. I'm a big fan of Ayn Rand, but I love, there's many. I wouldn't be able to just name
can't
one.
Can't pick one.
Can't name one.
What about
one.
Favorite movie?
Wow. I love Fight Club because it's just all this music.
Yeah.
It's just a great... is well put together. It's fun to watch. I keep, I like to watch it every now and then.
Yeah. The classic movies are always, I think,
yeah.
It's easier to watch classic movies than it is to reread books.
Yeah.
So movies are just, I think they're very enjoyable for people. Yeah. Aliens, real, not real, believe, don't believe.
I am sort of agnostic. I mean, to me, it's a little bit of religion.
Oh, come on. You can't be agnostic. Do you think they exist?
Somewhere out there, I do believe they exist. Maybe not in the form that we think.
Okay, that's fair.
You know, they could be larvas or animals or whatever, or things that we would not necessarily say, oh, well, that's, most people say it's an intelligent life form that's outside of Earth. I think so. I mean, certainly I'm not crazy about, like, I'm not going to the street and calling for,
you're not looking for UFOs from the roof
really.
Of a building in Manhattan.
I have other things on my mind on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. What is the one conspiracy theory that you think is absolutely ridiculous people believe in?
Oh, so many of those.
You're the first person I ever asked this to, but I'm genuinely curious.
9/11 to me, there's a lot of these conspiracy theories about how, the government was behind that. And like, I kind of look at that a little bit with like, wow, that's pretty
out there. Yeah.
So I would say probably that one.
Mine's the flat earthers.
That one is amazing.
That one's pretty hard.
That is unbelievable. Yeah, you just reminded me. Yeah, that's probably actually trumps it.
I love it. Before I let you go, you can ask me one question. What question do you have?
Can you say who your next guest gonna be?
I don't think we know yet. The podcast is its own beast at this point. I think we kind of started it and we weren't overly serious and it became a serious thing. We're releasing one a day now. So we spent a lot of time trying to figure out, you know, who to bring on, what do they have to talk about. You want to walk this line between I want everyone to be able to kind of tell their story or their perspective in their own words, mm-hmm. but I also don't want to give a platform to people who, you know, I think are maliciously scamming people, right? So, you know, there's people who obviously disagree with me on that framework in terms of when I apply it to certain guests, which is fine. But I do think now that it's every day, people expect it, and there's kind of you know, there's an understanding from my end that there's other people on the other end that are learning from this. I try to take it seriously and then try to make it more valuable. But when we first got started, it was just, hey, let me call up some friends, come in and you know, kind of let's bullshit a little bit. And somehow we got here.
Wonderful. You think the crypto winter is over? That's my second question, I guess.
Yeah, you can ask too. That's fine. Crypto winter. So we're recording this right now in April of 2019. You know, look, where's the bottom, right? Is a harder question than like, is crypto winter over? Winter to me is two different things. It's like price. So the actual like quantitative measurement of did we hit the bottom and now we're going the other way versus the psychological element or the qualitative argument of crypto winter, right? Price is near impossible to tell until we get hindsight, right? So like that's a little bit more difficult, but it does feel like there's more psychological excitement and kind of we've turned a corner in terms of people's sentiment, which price is likely to follow today because it's so human driven, right? In terms of the markets, there's not that many quant funds. There's not that many kind of high frequency guys. And so when you see that sentiment, just people are in a better mood. They feel like, oh, we just went through an 85% drawdown. We're all still here, right? And like, I still believe, right? I think it's actually going to continue to get adoption. It's a fixed supply asset for Bitcoin, right? Or some of the other applications. It just gives me the sense like if we aren't over with the crypto winter, we're really close to the end, right? It's kind of the way that I would put it. And we don't make any investment decisions based on that necessarily, but I think it's always important to kind of understand where you are in the macro trends. So
very cool. Thank you so much.
Yeah, listen, thank you for coming and spending time to do this, and we'll have to do it again in the future.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
One more word from our sponsor, BlockFi. Their new interest account allows you to securely deposit your Bitcoin or Ether at BlockFi and receive 6% annual interest paid monthly in cryptocurrency. This rate actually compounds, so you receive a 6.2% APY, which is very attractive given the alternatives. So you can actually take your Bitcoin, you can deposit it with BlockFi, and get paid an interest rate of 6% in return. Go check out BlockFi.com/pomp. Again, BlockFi.com/pomp to sign up and start earning interest on your crypto today.
Hey everyone, Pomp here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.